Welcome everybody to the last meditation class of this year. There's always another one tomorrow or something, but this is New Year's Eve. I think that may be why there's not so many people here today. Either they thought it had been cancelled because we're doing other events later on this evening, starting at 9 o'clock for New Year's Eve. But anyway, it's nice to see the devoted meditators here. The A class of meditation addicts. Is that right? Anyway, it's lovely for you to be here, and it's lovely to be able to talk a little bit about meditation before we actually do some meditation. In the old days, sometimes we just start meditating straight away, and that would not be very helpful, because sometimes people would rush here from doing something else, and it took them a while for their mind to settle down into the atmosphere of a meditation class. And it's always the case that your meditation preparation starts before you come in here, just the way that, you know, from parking your car, if you walk from the bus stop or something, the way that you can walk quietly, relaxed, into the hall to prepare your body into a less stress environment. And always remember that in one of the teachings of the Buddha, the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha always said the first thing to do is to find a calm, quiet place, and then just to sit down comfortably and establish mindfulness as the priority. And I always like that statement, establish mindfulness as a priority. Sometimes people translate the word as put mindfulness in front of you. That never made any sense to me, because in front of what? We're not supposed to have anything here, in front of my no self. Where's my no self located? It's not located anywhere. That's why it's called a non-self. It never made any sense. In front of where? So, again, learning more Pali, and learning just how the Pali works, it was very clear to me that's an idiom, which means give it priority. The first thing you do is to make sure you have enough mindfulness. And it's also one of the reasons why when people start meditating, they fall asleep, because their mindfulness is not really up to the task of meditating in the beginning. They need to encourage their mindfulness to be stronger and stronger before they're really able to do something like, you know, watch their mind and watch their breath and things like that. So I always was fascinated with the idea of the Buddha, before you even start watching the breathing or whatever other meditation object you're doing, to make sure your awareness, your mindfulness is strong. It makes a lot of sense, because I know that sometimes some people come here, they start meditating, you ask them to watch your breath go in, watch your breath go out, they can't do it for more than 1 or 2 minutes. And the reason is because the preparation hasn't been done. You can't just expect to like paint a wall without cleaning off the grease first of all. Now, you can't expect to cook a dinner when you've got no gas or electricity in the stove. You need to have all the ingredients, everything prepared first of all, and then it goes much more smoothly. And to me, it's the same with meditation. The preparation first of all is important. And that is one of the reasons why in the meditations I've been teaching here for the last few years, you really get into making sure you're aware of your body and relaxing your body. Maybe it's because I'm becoming an... No, I shouldn't say this. I said because I'm becoming an old monk, but you know I don't say that anymore. I am an old monk. In other words, you have to look after your body at the very beginning, otherwise it will get sore and ache afterwards. Or rather, even more so, to start aching and become tense in the middle of the meditation, which will disturb you. So I've always found it important to be able to sit down and make sure you're sitting down comfortably. And at the same time, that becomes the job of your mindfulness, to make sure you're sitting down comfortably. But the job of the mindfulness is not just to be sitting down aware and comfortably. It also shows you the importance of the kindness, because that's the how it works. The mindfulness shows you what's working, and it's the kindness which is the key to be able to have a comfortable body. And that kindfulness, the kindness and the mindfulness together, I found so powerful in so many other different ways of my life. The kindfulness means that whatever is in front of you right now, you give that kindness to. So I start with my body. The body's right here in front of me. And I give it importance. I don't just try and exploit this thing I call the body. I have to make sure that I look after it, care for it. That's where the kindness comes in. When I'm kind to my body, you can relax the body and get into a very comfortable posture. I usually don't spend that much time in my personal meditations just relaxing my body, but I always spend some time just making sure that everything is in a proper place. And I'm quite surprised that even though that I've been meditating a long time, and I think that my habits would be much wiser, that so I'd know straight away what's going to work, you don't use the same posture every time. Sometimes that my even legs, they don't cross them this way, cross them another way. Sometimes when I get to my back, sometimes I love just stretching my back, making it nice and upright. But sometimes I prefer just leaning back. You know how I find out what I need to do? The mindfulness is generated by asking my body. Often I ask my body, "Body, are you comfortable like this? Would you like to be adjusted?" When I ask my body those questions, then I get answers. It's what I call a practice of mindfulness. If I want to know where to put my hands, I ask my hands, "Where would you like to be?" And then they usually say, left hand under the right hand, thumb slightly touching. To me, that usually is the correct posture. But I ask my hands first of all. And whatever they suggest, that's what I follow. It's as if that I'm sensitive to the needs of my body. As if I look at the different parts of my body as independent entities. So I can ask my head, "How do you feel when it's leaning down a little bit like this?" And even just right now, my head says, "No, this is uncomfortable. Pull your head up a bit more." This is where you become aware of your bodily comfort. And it's the kindness which is allowing you to say, "Yes, if that's what your body wants, give it to it." And that means you get into a very comfortable position. Now, one of the reasons for doing that, as I said, is in order to have a comfortable 40 minutes of meditation. But the other reason is that it's the same technique which I use to get into the deeper meditations. Once the body is comfortable, by that time I've created enough mindfulness and kindness. I've strengthened it over the beginning of the meditation. So I find my awareness is stronger and my kindness is more accurate. I started on my body, on a part of the body which is not so necessary to relax, that's the legs, and then go back up to the torso, and the torso with all those organs in there, that's really important to make sure that's comfortable. And then once I've made those peaceful, then I use the same thing to get my mind to be peaceful. So let's have a look at how the mind works. "How are you feeling right now?" I say, "The mind. Is this what you want to feel?" And I give it kindness. It's a strange thing that many people, if they don't have sloth and torpor, they complain about restlessness and how to deal with restlessness in a meditation. Too often people keep thinking about all sorts of stupid things. And the point is, they're not even aware of what they're doing or why they're doing it. So sometimes I ask people who complain about restlessness to use that kindness and that awareness in a much more powerful way, the old Empress Three Questions meditation. You don't have to be aware of something like the breathing or peace or stillness or whatever it is you feel you should be doing. Instead, be aware of what you are doing. What is the object of your mind right now? What are you aware of? And have the kindness, not the rejection, I shouldn't be doing this. Have the kindness, as if this is what my mind needs to do right now, fine. But I will be with you. I'll be by your side at all times, your mindfulness and whatever you're being aware of. That is a kind of friendliness and kindness which I've often tried to explain as when you're with a good friend, your best friend, and then you don't just do what you want to do. Sometimes you ask your friend what they want to do. And if my friend, my mind, says, no, I just want to think about what I'm supposed to be doing later on this evening in my surprise party, which is going to surprise me, I think. That's why I call it a surprise. And then you think, well, if that's what you want to do, mind, fine. I'll be there right next to you, with you all times. When you treat your mind with friendliness, you don't want to part from one another. And sometimes, as I use that simile of being a good friend, a Kalyanamitta, if you wish, to so much so that whatever my mind does, I say, okay, I trust you. You're a good mind, I've known you for a long time, you won't do anything that evil. So if you want to think of all this stuff, fine. But I'm going to be aware of what you're thinking. In other words, the mindfulness remains, but the choice of what you're mindful of is not my choice. And I'm kind to whatever my mind wants to do. When that happens, it's as if your relationship you have with your mind changes. You really are good friends. Because to me that was always the cause of restlessness. Why would I want to run away from my mind? It was always because the relationship wasn't a kind one. I've often noticed if you're with a really good friend and that really good friend never asks you anything, never demands anything of you, never tells you what to do, of course that's such a good friend, you like their company, you like to hang out with them. And that's the same with my mind or whatever I'm aware of. You try and make sure you are friends. And that good friends means you can hang out together for hours. You don't need to run away from one another. So that's where you end up being with your mind, fully mindful, at peace, spending hours together. And if sometimes that's just what happens, you watch the breath together. Why? Because you're good friends. And that sort of overcomes the restlessness of the mind. That restlessness is one of those biggest problems. As long as you are here with your mind at all times, how can you ever call that restlessness? I don't try to discipline my mind with willpower. I discipline it with kindness. So my mind and I have a great relationship. We want to be together. And that is actually how you get very, very peaceful. It's not so much what you are aware of that is important when you meditate. What's really more important is how you are aware. What is the quality of that relationship between you and the object of your mind? And if the quality of that relationship is kindness, is peace, friendship, if you wish, then you will find that you soon get very, very peaceful. It's the attitude you have creates the peace. And the peace creates this wonderful stillness and makes the mindfulness stronger and stronger and more delightful. And that is where the mindfulness can really take off. I'm happy that I got to the point of the joy of meditation. Because as I will lead you through the relaxation of the body, there comes a time when the body is so relaxed, at least it does with me, you feel delightful, the body feels good. It's a type of pleasure. And it's the same with your mind. When the mind relaxes, there's a pleasure to that, a delight. It feels good. You know, the only theory which I can have to describe this is that your mind has a certain amount of energy available, and if you waste it with thinking, with being negative, you'll find that it just burns up too much really nice, important energy. But if you can instead be still as best you can, you find that energy goes into the mind and turns into this beautiful joy. Your mindfulness becomes stronger, more aware, and whatever you're aware of starts to look more beautiful. In Nepali, the Buddha said that's the Piti Sukha coming up with the breath or with whatever else you're watching. The most important thing is that something beautiful is happening and becomes enjoyable. And I always am delighted, you know, when other people meditate, and you know, they're my students, it might be in a retreat or a class, and they report afterwards they're having a good time. It's joyful, it's happy for them. Because when there's happiness and joy in there, that's when I realize the meditation is starting to work. And the joy and the happiness get even stronger. It becomes a beautiful path to follow. So that's just a bit of preamble. And it's not to give you more information, I think you know that information already. But it's just to imagine, to enable you to get into the mood of relaxation, joy, deeper mindfulness, kindness, friendship. And that will create a marvelous beginning of the meditation for you. So now, if you haven't already got in your best posture, please get in the best posture you can. And in a few moments, we'll start the meditation. Excellent. So if you wish, please close the eyes. It's usually more simple with a closed eye meditation. Which is one of our sense objects is put aside for the time being, the sense of sight. And then with the eyes closed, we start to just introduce another little thing which is often quite helpful, to make this little resolution, this is your meditation time. In today's world, it's often hard to find the minutes sufficient to have a good meditation. So now you have this time available in a convenient, comfortable place in this meditation hall at Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. You have the time, so please devote your time to the development of your mind's peace and wisdom and happiness. Grant yourself these moments of peace. And then we can start by just building up our mindfulness and kindness with our body. So I look at my feet and I'm kind to them. I ask them, how are you? What can I do for you? I'm kind to my feet as much as possible. As I encourage Venerable Ananda sitting next to me to be kind to his throat, give it lots of nice water. to cool it down. The first few minutes of the meditation is almost whatever my body needs, within some reason, to make it comfortable. You know, if you do have a cough, if you tense up against it, it always makes it worse. If you can relax and let it be, it soon subsides. So just a look at my feet, make sure they're really comfortable. And please excuse me if I spend too much time on this, but then if I spend sufficient time, even my feet feel really comfortable. There's a delight which I can experience. Maybe that's because I've been doing this such a long time. And I go to my lower legs, including the ankles and the calves. And I can feel them. It's like checking they're all okay and giving them some kindness. It's like, you know, you've got a little baby and you've tucked him in bed. And now you just stroke their hair, or you read them a little lullaby or whatever, until they can relax. And once my lower legs relax, they too feel this beautiful feeling of being at ease. Then going to my knees, and a special feeling, it's different than the feeling which I can notice in my legs, is a feeling in the knees. You know it very well, making sure that those sensations are at ease, relaxed. If there's any tightness, always imagine that feeling expanding. Because when I contract or squash things, that seems to make the pain worse. Just manage to allow things to open out and be at peace. The same for my thighs. Even though there's no difficulties there, I don't neglect them. There may always be some place which I don't see. So I sweep my awareness up my thighs till it reaches my butt. And anything I can do to make those thighs more peaceful, I will do so. Then I go to my butt itself, checking that it's evenly placed on the cushion. For you sitting on the chairs, making sure it's not too far forward, not too far back, but well supported. And then it becomes comfortable. And I go to my back, and today again, I feel like just stretching it up. Feels more comfy. You don't have to sit like that. Just what is comfortable for you? How do you know? You ask your back. It's almost like a little metaphor. You're aware of what's happening there. And then you can know whether it's in a good position or not. You don't want to cause yourself tightness in the body. But just a position which is relaxed and easy to maintain. And then I go up my body again from the bottom of my torso, up the digestive tracts to the stomach. If there's any doctors in here, I'll probably get this all wrong, but just the principle of it, sweeping the attention upwards. And relaxing everything as you go, just checking in on the parts of the body which aren't causing any problems, but also discovering some parts of the body which might be a bit tight and just need a slight bit of kindness to relax them and be peace and strong. That's why I go up to my stomach, check that everything's okay. up to my lungs. Heart, whatever I can feel in my body, relax all parts of it until I do get up to my shoulders. Maybe in the early days of meditation I would often have aches and pains in the shoulders. It could be very painful. It disturbed my meditation. And nowadays I relax those muscles at the beginning. And it causes me no problem anymore. I'm just focusing on those muscles. I'm just ignoring the rest of the body. Because when I focus on one part, I can give it so much good energy. And know so much of what that part of my body needs. It's really helpful. My shoulder muscles relax. Go down my arms, past my elbows, past my wrists, and then to my hands, making sure that the fingers are happy. I don't like being a control freak, so instead I just ask, how is that? My mindfulness gives me feedback. It gives me the information that my fingers are now really content. I can go straight back up the elbows, past the elbows, up to the shoulder muscles and back up to the neck. Relaxing my neck by moving my head around to get the optimum position with no stress on the neck muscles. And if I did have any irritation in my throat, I would look at that irritation. And don't try and control it, but care for it. Just give it a boost of kindness. And then lastly, go to my head. The part of my head which can often ache are the muscles in the forehead or around the eyes, around the mouth. I really try my best to find how to relax them. The way of relaxing I find the best is be aware, be kind, a bit of trial and error, and you soon find out what makes those muscles the most at peace. Your awareness is not just to know how they feel, but to know how they can be relaxed. When those muscles are as relaxed as I can get them, then I realize I've done the main part of my body sweep. All I need to do now is to look at the body as a whole, everything joined together. And if I find there's any part of my body which I hadn't given enough attention to, it will come up and I will focus my attention down there, give an extra boost of relaxation. And until I know that my awareness of my body has done its job, when I can feel relaxation right throughout the body. And the pleasant feeling which comes from that relaxation. The delight of bodily peace. Yeah, it took a few minutes, but that was a good investment. Building up mindfulness and kindness, while at the same time preparing the body before I let the body go. By letting the body go, I mean I've relaxed it as best as possible. And I prefer, instead of going to the breath, increasing the awareness of the mind now. There's one part of the mind which is my key point, the way I usually enter the mind, and that is with the idea, the concept, the experience of peace. What is peace? And how much peace do you feel right now? What increases the amount of peace that you feel? And what decreases it? One of the first things you notice is that thoughts of the past, fears of the future, they destroy any peace. So I make a decision to let go of any importance that I give to the past. I know that I learn much more from the present than you ever learn from the past. And also the present is where the future is made. So I give extra importance to this present moment. And I also notice the peace of my mind gets more stable, more deep. Just being here. And I can feel that peace. Can you describe peace? Don't even try. You cannot capture peace in a set of words. The words can take you close, but they can't really get close enough to really describe what it feels like to have peacefulness in your mind. Which is why to understand it and to know it fully, you do need silence. So I give myself the gift of silence. I don't have to take notes. I don't have to make plans. I'm silently aware in this moment of what's happening right now. With no pressure on me to write a report, no demands to say anything about it at all. To know something without thinking about it. And this is about as far as I can take you in the guided meditation. Now I leave you alone. It's in that present moment, in that silence. You can develop that peace even more. Things like the breath will come in by themselves. It's now getting close to the end of this meditation period. How do you feel? This is a time when, if you want to measure anything, or just feel what was the body like, what's the mind like, now's the time to do so. But don't just ask what it feels like. Often you can say, what was missing? What wasn't there? And here one learns the benefits of meditation, both bodily and in mind. I'm now going to ring the gong three times. After the third ringing of the gong, please open your eyes to end the meditation. So at the end of these meditations, it is the opportunity to ask any questions, especially about the meditation. We usually have some of these questions coming in from overseas. This is live stream, but in the meantime, okay, it's coming now. Has anybody got a question here about the meditation? Okay, let's see what we've got from overseas. Usually try and only for a quarter of an hour. Four questions. Oh. Yes, okay. From Dawn, from South Africa. How does one know if you are meditating correctly? That I find that it is hard work to the discipline of keeping your mind empty and focusing on consciousness. Is this right? I meditate on having no body. That is wonderful, but it has to be done naturally. In other words, that the body just disappears after a while. It's just what the way that the brain works. If nothing is happening with the body, then of course it starts to turn off. And one of the reasons why the breath, which is a bodily sensation, is important, is because it's so refined, and when everything else in the body's five senses turns off, then sometimes that's the last one to disappear, just the breath. You've got the breath, and then from there, the breath can become so smooth that that too disappears, and then the five senses have gone, and you're aware of the mind. And to be aware of that mind, don't choose what to do, because the right way that the mind manifests is usually using these nimittas. Great joy and happiness with these beautiful lights in the mind. And if that happens, then of course you know about it. So how do you know if you're meditating correctly? How do you know if you're doing the sweeping of the body correctly? You'll know because there's a delightful feeling comes. A very clear, delightful feeling of body is nice and relaxed. How do you know that the mind is relaxed? Again, the delightful feeling which comes when the peace, present moment awareness, when the mindfulness is strong. And once the mindfulness is strong, then you can have a look at this mind and it's not dull. Often I gave the simile that you can be in a well-lit room in a forest in a quiet area, and you go outside and it's dark. At first you can't see anything. Then after a short while, sort of the night vision comes up. Your pupils dilate, you can see more. And that's a good example of even meditation. At first your mindfulness is not strong. But once it gets stronger and stronger, even when the body vanishes and you're experiencing the mind, you can see so much more of it. Even when you start watching your breath, naturally as you get more and more peaceful, mindfulness increases and you can see more of the breath. So often, well, not as I say, the Buddha said from the beginning, very beginning of an in-breath to the end of the in-breath. The spaces in between the breaths, beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath. Naturally just happens, you become more aware. Next one from Gloria. I recently started to understand more about the saying, if you don't disturb the noise won't disturb you. Is it the essence of meditation? Does it apply to all mental and emotional states? And it's not the essence, it's one of those very skillful means of making sure that you don't spoil the meditation by trying to fight little battles which aren't worth fighting. The noise doesn't disturb you, you disturb the noise. So there might be somebody bangs the door. There might be the sound of an aircraft overhead. Or there might be the sound, it used to happen some time ago, you do a meditation here on a New Year's Eve and somebody decides to start a party in one of the houses behind. You know, what are you going to do? You can't ask them to stop, they've already started, so you don't disturb the noise. You make the noise the object of your meditation. And then you become peaceful. Your reaction is not there anymore. Is there ever a time where I should force where I go in my meditation? I remember Ajahn Chah's chicken shit meditation. Chicken shit meditation. I can't remember that. So anyway, maybe you can email later on. So what do you mean, Ajahn Chah's chicken shit meditation? But to force where you go in meditation, I would say no. Especially the deeper you go, the force should be actually totally taken away. So you just rest, relax, and then you're not forcing yourself to go somewhere else. You tend to sort of go in. What happens in meditation, it's a simile which I usually use on retreats, the Thousand Petal Lotus. As you are aware, the mindfulness and the kindness, you actually allow those petals to open up. One by one they open up and you go inwards, always inwards. You don't force the lotus to open. The only effort is there to restrain the mind from doing such things as forcing. You allow things to be. This is a good question. John from Canada. How can I stop hating the ones I love? It's a good question because it means you love these people and you enjoy their company, but you're asking from them things which they can never provide, and that turns into hate. You don't want them to leave, you want them to be around you or to be there, but you know that all forms of love have to include a lot of letting go. How can, you know, parents love their children so much, but you can see them sometimes saying their kids are driving them crazy. Of course they drive you crazy if you think to control them and to teach them has to be done through force or through wanting. The best way is to just teach your kids by example. If you are a loving, caring, wise parent, you'll find that will encourage the children much more than words and rules and punishments. And anyway, Ajahn, What are ways to recognize when we are transitioning from the more active joy in first jhana to more tranquil happiness in second jhana? Thank you. You don't recognize when this is happening because that will be disturbing the meditation. In the deep meditations, especially of the jhanas, the mind is so still, so powerful and one-pointed, you don't have perspective. All you do is whatever amount of letting go you enter those jhanas with, that will determine of where you end up. So after you emerge from these jhanas, that is when you look back, and it's almost impossible not to look back, a really big experience. You look back and see what was happening and how that experience developed. Please remember the power of mindfulness, which is there in things like jhanas, is huge. That's why it's very hard to find words to describe that amount of mindfulness. But it is similar to the amount of mindfulness you have in life-threatening situations, like a car crash or falling off a cliff or something. It's as if your mindfulness increases enormously. And you can remember these experiences so clearly. If it is a jhana, then you have very perfect memory of it afterwards. Because it's intense mindfulness. And that's afterwards you see the transition from one state to another state in jhanas, how you're going inwards. But the transition is not so much what they call in this question active joy and tranquil happiness. The thing which you notice more than anything else is the stillness of the mind. In the first jhana, the mind is not perfectly still. It moves on to the object, holds on to the object, which is bliss. And as you settle, that movement goes and you become perfectly still. That seems to be the most important part of those experiences and the most important difference. How still are you? That's why they always call the bliss of the second jhana the bliss of samadhi. Samadhija, piti sukha. Anyway, that was a technical question. Now you have the question from the floor. Or not so far from the stool. You're sitting on a stool.
I actually don't have a question.
Yes.
I just wanted to note that the new research is saying that people will be living up to 120 years. So that means that you are not old monk, but just mid-age monk.
I'm middle-aged. Oh my goodness. If this is what it feels like being middle-aged, what is going to feel like being 120? We'll see what happens. You know, the extent of life, I can't understand why people are worried about the extent of life. The most important thing is the quality of your life. 120 years, when the last years of your life you're not very clear and your body is not that sort of peaceful, and it's not that joyful. 120 years? If it's high quality, great.
That's what they are saying.
Yeah, I don't know who they are, but... Sometimes, you know, scientists, they say these things. I'm not really... This is what... Something... I remember a little qualification with science. They had what they call the hard sciences and the soft sciences. And the hard sciences were just going on experiment and also just very, very rigorous reasons why it works, why it doesn't work. And the softer sciences were going on a lot of supposition and probability theory, getting a lot of cases and then finding out where these cases seem to suggest. But it wasn't actually so firm. so reasonable and so logical. They called it soft science. And I remember even my friends at Cambridge, when I started off as a mathematician, which was, you know, quite hard, especially pure maths. And when I went into applied maths and theoretical physics, they thought I was giving up, you know, my devotion to logic and reason. There's just too many assumptions. And it's a good, okay, this may sound funny to you, but for a while, not that long, somebody was actually saying that smoking had its advantages, smoking cigarettes, because they proposed some research, and it seemed to be convincing, that if you smoke cigarettes, you didn't get dementia. Until somebody saw through that very quickly. Yes, it's true, you don't get dementia if you smoke cigarettes, because you don't live long enough to get dementia. So that was just one example there. You have to be sort of quite rational and try and poke holes in things. Be a bit rebellious. Okay, anyway. The same was actually with that research, which was far more delusive about if you drink alcohol, especially like red wines, that you have less cardiac problems. You get less heart attacks. I don't know if you remember that research. And that research was totally disproved when they found out that the sample which they used to, you know, to so-called prove this, was that people in California did a very wide survey of people, and then someone said the reason why, if you drank red wine, you had less problems with cardiac arrest, was because the people who could afford red wine were the more economically high-standard people, earning more money. The lower economic range of people in California could not afford red wine. They would drink other things. And it was their economic status which was explaining just why they didn't have so much cardiac disease, not the drinking of red wine. And when they made appropriate adjustments, people in the same economic range in California who drank red wine and those who didn't, it became quite clear that those who didn't were far healthier. So if you, I'm sorry to say this at New Year's, if you're going to a party tonight and thinking, oh, getting some wine is going to be good for my health. But it isn't. I'm just being fair with you. If you can afford red wine in California, that means you can afford good medicine. And that was what was the cause of good health. Make sense? It's not the sort of news that some people would like to hear, but that's what it says. Okay, is there any other questions or comments? Okay, so it is just now the end of the meditation period. We've got another few hours before we start our evening celebration. Thank you for those of you who came now. I know that some of you will be staying on till 9 o'clock or whatever, but you might want to go out and get yourself a meal or something. We do have some snacks here, I believe, at 10 o'clock. But anyway, now I'm going to be going over and setting up for this evening's surprise event. Okay. Thank you. Glenda, are you still living in Waterman's? Same old house. Yeah, that's good.